The following episode of Bookmark was first broadcast March 19th, 2024.
Every day I read the book. Chapter 1, you didn't really get along. Chapter 2, I think I fell in love.
All right, good afternoon and welcome to Bookmarked on KCSM.org, your true community radio station, where today the book under discussion is Foster by Claire Keegan. Keegan is an Irish writer. I didn't think of this as part of a St. Patrick's Day celebration, but maybe we can think of it as a continuation of that. And my guest, whom I'm very happy to welcome back for the fourth or fifth time, I hope, is Chris Gardner.
Hello, hello.
All right. Chris is Associate Professor of English and Dual Credit Liaison at Austin Community College. He's also a member of our KCSM Governing Board and, not incidentally, Chair of the Programming Committee. Do you want me to say anything else about you?
That's all the world needs to know about me. Let's jump to a book.
Okay, let's jump to the book. Claire Keegan is known for her short stories. She doesn't seem to have written anything over, say, 100 pages or something.
No, yeah, nothing
at all. Her collections include Antarctica, Walk the Blue Fields, The Forester's Daughter, and So Late in the Day, Stories of Women and Men. Her stories have been published in The New Yorker, The Best American Short Stories, Granta, and The Paris Review. Foster has been published as a standalone novella, and we might also mention, but possibly not, the New Yorker version of the title story of So Late in the Day. I'll summarize Foster just for a start. It's deceptively simple. Is that a good word?
I think so.
Okay.
I think so.
It's told in the first person and present tense by a little girl who is sent to spend the summer with the Kinsellas, who are relatives that she hardly knows. They say, oh, we saw you when you were in a pram, but she doesn't remember. We can tell from her account that their kindness, their childless contrast with her treatment at home, and that she kind of expands over the summer. In the course of the narrative, she learns that her hosts have suffered the loss of a child, and she bonds with them strongly enough that she's very sorry to return home at the end. Anything to add?
No, other than I really like the choice of the word expands there. I think that's exactly what happens. She lives a very small life in her very busy home and here has some space to breathe and does exactly that, expands a little bit and finds parts of herself that she didn't know she could encounter.
Yeah, exactly. And you chose this writer and this book. Would you like to tell us why?
I am just knocked out by Claire Keegan these days. I'm trying as quickly as I can to read every single thing that she's done. I checked this out of the library, the wonderful San Marcos Public Library, because it was short. And I was struggling to get through a number of longer books, and I wanted a quick win. So I grabbed Foster. I had a meeting one afternoon in Lockhart, and I sat down at a little cafe on the square for some breakfast and opened the book, and I did not stir until I had finished it. It is comparatively bite-sized. I think it's 92 pages, but they're small pages with a lot of white space, and I found myself quickly falling in to a book where, as you intimated already, doesn't have a lot of plot. There's not a whole lot that happens. One summer, she went and stayed with some people she didn't know. She got water from the well. Mm-hmm. She cut the rhubarb. She learned a secret. She went to the sea, and then she came home. And the amount of, to come back to it, expansion that Keegan packs into a tale with so little plot to hang on is alarming to me.
Alarming and admirable, apparently. Yeah, and that says something about her. Why it's, you know, we wouldn't it can be told in these few pages.
Yes.
Because it's just this. All of the reviewers, and I certainly agree with them, that I read about this have absolutely been bowled over by her creation of the child's point of view. So how do you know that this is what a child is seeing? Do you have comments on that? How do you think she creates that as you read the book?
With expertise and care.
Yeah. I guess I'm looking for specific. Examples. For example,
I think I'm going to use all of my salutary words in this broadcast today. I think that this narrator, is a wonderful noticer of things. You mentioned in an off-air conversation that she does a really nice job of using present tense here, and I think that helps us be in the child's mind as she notices things, and as just some of the things that she notices leave the impression on her that they also leave on the audience. Mm-hmm. So I think part of it is that instantaneous noticing watches and gives us the chance to watch her think, learn, and grow. And it's that combination, I think, that the child is such a great noticer and that a careful reader can see a little more than the child can that makes the voice work so well.
Yeah. Yeah. I had a example that I particularly liked partly because it's so simple. When she first arrives, and again, it's like Keegan, not to say that she's dirty. She does look down at her dirty feet in sandals at one point, but Mrs. Kinsella says, "I think it's past time you took a bath," you know, gently. She doesn't say, "Oh, you're a dirty little girl" or anything. She just, the woman takes me through to a bathroom, plugs the drain, and turns the taps on full. The bath fills and the white room changes so that a type of blindness comes over us. We can see everything, and yet we can't see. And apparently she's never had the experience of watching a room fill up with steam before, and so that's how she describes it. And that kind of little thing is just amazing.
Her attention to details like that is wonderful. Her in that sentence being Keegan rather than the child, but also the child.
Mm-hmm. I told you I found online a conversation that Keegan had with a class that she visited. This story is, or novella, or whatever you want to call it, is read in schools in Ireland, which we were both pretty impressed to learn.
Lucky Ireland.
Well, but it'd be hard too. In some ways, I guess the assumption is that children reading it might identify with the little girl.
Mm-hmm.
I guess, but I think it would be both easy and hard to talk about as a teacher. I don't know.
I wonder at what level it's taught. I struggle to imagine this story being taught to children the age of the narrator herself, but children with just a little bit more experience,
yeah.
I think,
yeah,
and
that's
a little bit more looking back can get a great deal from it.
And anyway, Keegan actually commented on the present tense. Since you mentioned it, I want to read what she said, which kind of confirms what you assumed. I told it in the present tense because, again, I wanted it to be a portrait of a piece of time. And she didn't know when this would end or how it would end, and so I wanted her to go from day to day with the feeling of real uncertainty. And I think if I'd written it in the past tense, that would have taken some of that away. It would have already happened rather than being something that was happening. And a minute ago, you mentioned her age. She is not given an age that I remember, nor a name. We just know that she's a girl, and we figure that she's somewhere between toddlerhood and puberty, but we don't exactly know. What did you think of? Did you find yourself supplying her with an age? Why would Keegan do that?
I think there are a lot of things about this that are absent, that are just missing. And I think part of that, again, is that we're from the child's point of view. I think it would be even more awkward if the child was like, this is when I was nine, particularly because she is in the present tense all the time. We also never get a name for the woman that she is with.
Yeah, Kate commented on that one, too.
We learn Kinsella's name eventually. But this is one of the things that we aren't told. She's small enough to sit comfortably in someone's lap. Mm-hmm. She is old enough to be trusted with a great many tasks and not old enough to be trusted with all of them.
Right.
And that's a really interesting age. That age is a really strong bit of becoming. And I think that...
Well, you have girls who are considerably older than this now, but so what age would you put her then?
Somewhere in that 7 to 10. Mm-hmm. 7 to 10.
Yeah.
When she runs to the mailbox, Kinsella trains her a bit, has her run down to fetch the mail every day, and keeps calling her long legs. So she's hitting some kind of a growth spurt in there. Somewhere probably around 8, 9 for me is the right spot.
Mm-hmm. What did you think of the fact that the Kinsella, actually somewhere way further on in the story, we learn that Mr. Kinsella's first name is John and that his wife's name is Edna, but they're never... When the narrator talks about them, it's just the woman or Kinsella. Did you wonder about that? How did you see that as figuring in the story as a whole?
The first time I read through this, there was so much tension for me as a reader, and I got to the end and couldn't figure out how she had done it. And I think part of it is these little gaps. Part of it is that she doesn't know what to call the woman. Part of it is that she doesn't know when this is going to end. This drop-off is like an open parenthesis, and she doesn't know when it's going to close. Her father hardly even says goodbye to her when he departs and doesn't say that he...
Don't fall in the fire, you, is what he says to her.
Yeah, she falls in something else instead. But she doesn't know... either when he will come back or for certain that he will come back. She's heard her mother say they can keep her as long as she wants, but that's all she's got to go on. And that uncertainty for her left me worried that something terrible was going to happen all the way through my first reading.
I kind of worried about something terrible happening and was relieved at the end when nothing really terrible happens.
Agreed.
You know.
But I think that's a particularly wonderful trick to maintain that uncertainty and that tension throughout without leading up to some tragic or minorly tragic incident is a tribute to her craft.
Yes.
And how carefully she constructs all of this.
Keegan commented on the use of names, and I thought it was interesting. She prefaced these remarks by saying that she went to New Orleans at 17 and I think studied at...
I think it's Loyola.
Loyola, yeah. And she said when she did that, she wasn't used to people using her name all the time, that the Irish are funny about names. Maybe they think they have a lot of power or something. And then she adds this comment... If you were brought into the house and you were the girl and I was Mrs. Kinsella, if I did say to you, call me Edna or Auntie Edna or Mrs. Kinsella, you would not know what to call me, and she doesn't. So you couldn't call me anything. It was a way of keeping you at arm's length, not telling you what you can call me or how you can address me. And she thinks that Mrs. Kinsella does this so she won't get too fond of the little girl. I think she had a fear, Keegan says, of getting too fond of a child who she knew she would have to lose at the end of the summer. And so one of the ways she handled this, I think she handled it well, was to give her no name to address her by.
Quick sidebar also that I just am delighted all the time when writers talk about their characters like real people in the world.
Mm-hmm.
She's complimenting Mrs. Kinsella for her good choices.
Yeah.
And that always tickles me.
Yeah. I I think all writers do that to some extent. Yeah. I just finished going through Louise Erdrich's the last report on the miracles at Little No Horse, and at the very end, Erdrich kind of suggests that maybe some of this just came to her directly from these people, from characters, from mysterious letters that were left behind, and so on. And says it's that same sort of thing. I think you've read that book, if I remember correctly. This is just another favorite glimpse of the child's point of view. Maybe you have one too, but
I think we've got the same one here.
No, okay. It's her father is talking to Kinsella when he drops her off, and they talk about the weather and how it needs to rain, and you know, there is a pause during which my father spits, and then their conversation turns to the price of cattle, the EEC, butter mountains, and the cost of lime and sheep dip. It is something I am used to, this way men have of not talking. They like to kick a divot out of the grass with a boot heel, slap the roof of a car before it takes off, and to spit, to sit with their legs wide apart, as though they do not care. That last thing.
It's exquisite. It's exquisite. Yeah. And again, a child who's really carefully noticing all of these gestures, all of these ways of, as she says, not talking, are familiar to her. She's been watching real carefully.
Yeah, as though they do not care, so they're invested in the conversation or the person with whom they are conversing. So her home life, and this is, you know, I was just asking you if you didn't think that it seems to me that it would be both easy and difficult to address this, because her home life, if you indirectly reveals a kind of stereotype, an Irish stereotype in a way. The father evidently drinks, gambles. There's a lot of kids. The mother is pregnant again, which is one of the reasons why the little girl is sent away. And I wonder what you thought of both as a stereotype or about the ways what Keegan does to reveal her home life without describing it directly.
Yeah, I think that she does a lot of this real carefully. I don't think she ever says the word Catholic, but offers up a critique of Catholic Irish life here. Probably a gentle one and a sympathetic one. But a critique nonetheless.
She was born on a farm in Ireland.
Keegan herself was.
Yes, and I don't know if she was raised Catholic, but I would bet yes.
Yes, I would bet yes. Yeah, we see it in tiny little glimpses. We see that life before the kind of confusion of that home. She's startled by so many of the things in the Kinsella's house. By how quiet things are, by how clean things are, by the fact that they have a freezer. She's never imagined one. By the fact that so many things are done, and they're both so industrious that Kinsella and the mother and Edna are both busy all the time. At her home, her mother is never still and always working, and her father is always off being functionally useless, gambling away the heifer. I have no love for the father here. We are not meant to.
No.
But let's say, among other things, that he would never have gambled away a bull. A heifer's just a heifer, and he's happy to let a female cow go, but a bull would be something different entirely.
I hadn't thought of that. But
The baby pram is broken. One of the children tried to treat it like a wheelbarrow and broke the wheel off of it, and it is still home and broken as the mother sits there juggling at least five and perhaps more children, and he's done nothing to fix it. The Kinsellas are startled that the hay hasn't been put up in the barn yet by the time she arrives at the beginning of summer, and then he comes in and lies about how tired he is from putting the hay up all the time.
Oh, yeah.
He says he's got to go home to spray the spuds, and the Kinsellas both know very well there are no spuds to spray this time of year, and you don't need to do it overnight. He's just going off to have what he will call a liquid dinner. So we see the quiet misery of the home, or the cacophonous misery of the home, through what we see of him, and particularly in the ways the Kinsellas treat him, I think. He is both a laughable figure to them and a nuisance. Edna can't even look at him. In the scenes that he's in the kitchen, she is staring at a piece on the wall as though there were a picture there, because she refuses to make eye contact with him.
That's right. Yeah, that one went right by me, but you've been through it twice. Yeah. The other way, besides these observations that Keegan conveys things, is sort of overheard dialogue. And there's not a lot of dialogue, but, you know, when her father drops her off, he says, "She'll eat you out of house and home, but you can work her." And that's all. And Kinsella immediately says, "Well, she'll help my wife around the house, but she's not going to have to do farm work."
Yeah, for her father, this is a transactional relationship. Yeah. I will put food in the machine if the machine will do work for me.
Yeah,
but that's not something we would commonly call love. And one doesn't wonder if the children don't outwork the father back at the home.
Insofar as they're able. And you mentioned work, and actually work is very important in here. I'm eager to read more of her, but in the other story we read, the guy, it was a very different one, but you see the man at work. And something that she observes about the Kinsellas is that they get a lot done, but they never seem rushed or pressured about it.
Yeah.
They just kind of, she talks about the things we're going to do today, and then we just do them.
Yeah. They never hurry, but they never stop.
Yeah. All right. I think that we are up on our first break.
On the radio, this is the Sweet Honey Bear Blues on Tuesday at 8 o'clock till 10 o'clock. You got me giving you what you just didn't know you needed.
Bookmarked is brought to you in part by the Whitliff Collections. Now on exhibition, I Pray You Survive, Writing on the Edge. The Whitliff explores how our best writers have personally confronted life or death situations, from war to pandemics, race riots, and murder, to create their groundbreaking work. On display now at the Whitliff Collections at Texas State University. For more information, please contact us at thewhitliffcollections.txstate.edu.
Welcome back to Bookmarked on KZSM 104.1 and KZSM.org, your true community radio station, where today we are talking about Foster by Claire Keegan with Chris Gardner. And one of the things we've been exploring with this book is how things are revealed without being presented directly. And in this case, it's the home life of this child who has been sent to live with relatives for the summer, and what's life really at home. And we were wondering, you said some people who've written about this book have said that they thought she was abused. I mean, she's certainly neglected. That's pretty clear. And that she's not, at least that her father, at least, how you just described his relationship, that it's sort of transactional. You put food in her, and then maybe she'll work. And that's about all. So we don't know whether she's punished or not, although I wonder, when she's starting to think about leaving the Kinsellas towards the end, which she doesn't want to do. She says, "I stand there and stare at the fire, trying not to cry. It is a long time since I have done this, and in doing it, remember, it is the worst thing you can possibly do. I don't so much hear as feel Kinsella leaving the room." But when she says, "It's the worst thing that you can possibly do," I hear somebody saying, "I'll give you something to cry about." and whacking her, you know.
That's interesting.
You know, but because why is crying the worst thing you could possibly do?
I read it to being trying not to cry.
Microphone.
Oh, sorry. I read it as trying not to cry is the worst thing you can possibly do.
Okay.
And I think that they're both there.
Yeah.
I think that they're both there. Crying is the worst thing you can do in that home. And also trying not to cry is just the worst. It's the worst.
Yeah,
it feels terrible.
It makes your head feel terrible.
Yeah,
you know?
It does.
Yeah. What did you make of the passage in which... and we can call her Mrs. Kinsella, even though the our narrator only calls the woman. She says, "We have no secrets in this house." And they, Mrs. Kinsella says, "Come down to the well with me." Something about the way she says this makes me wonder if it's something we are not supposed to do. And I don't know what that might be. Is this secret? What? I mean, am I not supposed to tell? There are no secrets in this house. Do you hear? Do you hear me? Yeah. It's not yeah, it's yes. What is it? It's yes. Yes what? Yes, there are no secrets in this house. Where there's a secret, she says, there's shame. And shame is something we can do without. Okay, I take big breaths so I won't cry. Oh, and then Mrs. Here she's trying. Here again, she's trying not to cry.
Yeah.
You're just too. She puts her arm around me. You're just too young to understand. And I didn't. What did you make of that, or did you think it better to not make anything at all of it?
I thought. Oh, I think so many things about this. Mrs. Kinsella is a wonderful character. And a really complicated one. She's trying here to do the right thing, and she so often does the right thing by her narrator. She's so often doing exactly what we as readers hope that she will, showing her surprising kindness and being a person in her life who cares about her just exactly as she is. Here, I think Mrs. Kinsella is also just outright lying to herself. There are secrets all over this house. No one says, "We're so glad you're here. We lost our own son, and you're filling the void in our parent heart." No one mentions the boy to her at all, and he remains effectively a secret until the busybody neighbor spills the beans later on.
Yeah, and at that point, however, they don't. She feels brave enough to tell them what she has been told, and they don't deny it.
Right.
You know?
So no denial. But we're cutting hairs on the word secrets here a little bit. And I think that Mrs. Kinsella is, lying here a little bit and lying to herself often, believing that she can keep this child all summer long and hold her at a distance and not care for her is a way of deceiving herself and a way of keeping secret from her own self. The desire that she has for this to mother someone.
I like your idea that she's sort of lying to herself. The little kindness is one of my favorites, and which is almost comic, but also very touching. Is the narrator wets the bed, although that is not said directly. I wake in this new place to the old feeling of being hot and cold all at once. Mrs. Kinsella does not notice until later in the day when she is stripping the bed, and she said, "These old mattresses, they weep. They're always weeping." What was I thinking? That is so kind.
It is so kind. And when Kinsella comes home later, he says, "What's going on here?" And she says, "The mattresses are weeping again."
Mm-hmm.
And he immediately jumps in and redoubles that kindness and preserves her dignity in that way. And they do the same thing when her father leaves and has left her with nothing but the clothes that she arrived in, because they came with nothing but the clothes that
she arrived in. Well, there was a suitcase, because she mentions that her mother put a pair of clean pants in the suitcase, and they said something about you. So we don't know whether the father has forgotten the suitcase at their home or forgotten to take it out of the car.
Gotcha.
But whatever happens,
I missed that there was a suitcase.
But her mother's doing, of course.
Yeah.
You know.
He leaves her without her bits and bobs.
Yeah.
And they know that something far more complex is going on. And they both very quickly, I imagine them just kind of giving each other the eye over the top of her head. And they both very quickly jump into this and say, oh, of course, that's why you're upset. And they allow her to take cover a little bit and to keep that pain a little bit secret, despite saying out loud that there are no secrets.
And they and she imposes what I think of as a strange sort of cure. I don't know if it's intended to be a cure for bedwetting or not. I never heard of such a thing. Have you ever eaten Weetabix?
Oh, it's dreadful.
Oh yes, I know it's dreadful. It's I mean with here when she eats it, she says it. It tastes a bit like the dry bark of a tree must taste. And then if you put milk on it, it becomes totally soggy immediately. But she says that it's something that she, Mrs. Kinsella, does for her complexion. She offers some to the little girl who does it because it's eats a lot of it because it's given to her. And later that afternoon when Mrs. Kinsella is making the bed, she looks at me pleased. Your complexion is better already, see? All you need is minding. And I don't know if there's some kind of assumption here that this terribly dry stuff is going to
dry her out from the inside.
I just, you know, but it seems to do the trick. And of course, what might do the trick is just that someone is taking care of her, and so she's less anxious.
Yeah, and this is another of those sly moments where we see what life at home is like. All you need is a little minding, and she doesn't even get a little minding back at the house.
Yeah. She probably gets, when she wakes up, she thinks that she will be sent home, you know, when her lapse is discovered. But that does not happen.
Yeah, and that's more of that uncertainty for her. For a long time, she believes that any small mistake might get her bounced from the garden, and that she might be sent directly back home and cast out of paradise for making a single error.
Yeah, which suggests that she certainly is punished at home, if perhaps not corporally, but certainly.
Yes.
You mentioned, I think you mentioned it already when we were on the air, about her running. Mr. Kinsella takes her out and encourages her to run to the post box and back. And apparently, can you run? What? Are you fast on your feet? Sometimes. Well, run down there to the end of the lane as far as the box and then run back. I will not attempt an Irish accent, okay? The post box, and she goes there and goes back. And apparently, he does this every day, and she gets faster and faster. And it's just something, a way of paying attention to her, something to do, something to make her feel strong.
I think all of those things. I think I like the last best. I think that's why Keegan does it. I'm not entirely certain why I believe Kinsella does it. But I think that this reminder that we can incrementally, day by day, improve and make ourselves better through attention and effort is part of what Keegan is after here. Mm-hmm. This is physical growth for her this summer. Yeah. Not just the internal growth that she goes through. And also, she's finally eating normally. When you mentioned earlier that she eats a lot of the Weetabix, despite the fact that Weetabix is terrible.
Right.
In the same way, the first time they go to the well, she drinks 6 full drams and just can't stop drinking, can't stop eating. Certainly, she is growing. But also, there's not enough food to go around at the house.
Yeah, that's pretty clear.
And this is a chance for her to eat a bunch and get real strong. So maybe Kinsella's after that kind of training regimen too. I'm not certain.
Yeah. Yeah. As you mentioned already, we learn that the Kinsellas have lost a child, a boy, in this horrible farm accident. He follows the dog into the slurry. You know what the slurry is?
I do know what the slurry is.
And drowned. But they don't, they don't tell her, although they acknowledge it when she mentions it. And I wondered, I mean, you talked about, and we both had this response of, you worry through the book that something really bad is going to happen. Another thing, I did find myself thinking that possibly the Kinsellas had lost a child. I was thinking more of an infant or a miscarriage or something like that. But I don't know. Did you feel like she was sort of hinting at that possibility before it comes up, or is that just me?
I did not read carefully in the first instant. I was so focused on what was happening to our narrator that I wasn't watching all of the breadcrumbs, which I think on a second reading are pretty clear.
Yeah.
When she doesn't have any clothes, guess what? There are clothes that mostly fit her here.
Mm-hmm.
You can roll the sleeves up a little bit and tighten the canvas belt and she's good to go. There's a room with what's obviously a child's wallpaper on it. And I didn't stop to ask myself why.
Mm-hmm.
So when the revelation came later in the novel, I was happy to be startled by it. But had I been reading more carefully, I probably would not have been.
I didn't. And now that's interesting, because I didn't pick up on the clothes or the wallpaper either in thinking that, okay, this was a boy of some age, you know, old enough to wear clothes that were a little too big for her. But I did, there was something about the loss when Mrs. Kinsella thinks the narrator is sleeping in the beginning, and she says, if you were mine, I wouldn't send you to live with strangers, you know.
Yeah.
And I was thinking a stillbirth or a miscarriage or something like that in there. The wallpaper, yeah, we got to say something about the wallpaper. It's for a room, and when later we realize, oh, it's obviously for a boy's room, it's got trains of every color race across the wallpaper. There are no tracks for these trains, but here and there a small boy stands off in the distance, waving. He looks happy, but some part of me feels sorry for every version of him. I roll onto my side, and though I know she wants neither, wonder if my mother will have a girl or a boy this time. And a foreshadowing of the boy who did live in this room, maybe. A projection of her own loneliness.
Yeah, both of those things for sure. There are no tracks for the trains, so there's an aimlessness implied here. The boy seems to be happy, and she's sad for him nonetheless.
Mm-hmm.
Is she sad because there's no one waving back? Because each time he appears, he's still alone? And then to follow it with that line that says, I roll onto my side, and though I know she wants neither, wonder if my mother will have a girl or a boy this time.
Mm-hmm.
That, we wonder again about her age. She's old enough to know that Mama doesn't want another kid.
Yeah.
And that's old enough to know a great deal, it seems to me.
Yeah, but it wouldn't be that hard in a small house to pick up on, the mothers. And we wondered, it does mention my sisters and not my brothers, so we wonder, again, we don't know for sure, if this family has all girls, and that's part of the father's indifference to her and perhaps part of why they have a lot of kids, because the father would want a boy.
Oh, that's interesting. I hadn't.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, it's all these things that are kind of just
drips and drabs,
just under the surface. Mm-hmm. The prospect, and there's a scene that I'm not sure I completely understand about buying her clothes. Things are going along well. I think it's past time we got you togged out, girl. This is 41, chapter 5. I keep not giving you page numbers. I am wearing a pair of navy blue trousers and a blue shirt the woman took from the chest of drawers. What's wrong with her? Mrs. Kinsella says. Tomorrow's Sunday, and she needs something more than that for Mass. I'll not have her going as she went last week. Sure, isn't she clean and tidy? You know what I'm talking about, Edna. Why don't you go up there and change, and I'll run us all into Gori, which is the town nearby. The woman keeps on picking the gooseberries from the colander, stretching her hand out, but a little more slowly each time for the next. At one point, I think she will stop, but she keeps on until she is finished, And then she gets up and places the colander on the sink and lets out a sound I've never heard anyone make and slowly goes upstairs. And she's left. Kinsella's eyes are not quite still in his head. It's as though there's a big piece of trouble stretching itself out in the back of his mind. And then he sends her upstairs to wash her hands and face. She finds that the woman is in the bathroom. "It's all right," the woman said. And after a while, she comes out. "Sorry for keeping you." She has been crying, but she isn't ashamed. "It'll be nice for you to have some clothes of your own. And Gori is a nice town. I don't know why I didn't think of taking you there before now." And I don't understand the woman's initial...
Before I say what I think I understand, I stole an exercise from George Saunders, who is a wonderful writer, where with my students, we have one student read a paragraph out loud and have the next student tell us something that they noticed about the paragraph, and then we as a class talk about the thing that has been noticed.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to do that with this entire story.
Yeah.
Every time you read a sentence, I'm like, oh, look at that. Oh, look at that. Oh, look at that. I think here that Mrs. Kinsella is just trying to turn the clock back. I think that's what I'm getting from it.
Mm-hmm.
She has dressed him up in her dead boy's clothes. And when she runs around in those clothes, certainly a couple of times a day, Mrs. Kinsella gets to look up and imagine a world where he never left.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that is enough for her.
Mm-hmm.
But now they've been to Mass once, mm-hmm. and everyone in town has seen her wearing the dead child's clothes, and they surely know.
Mm-hmm.
So Kinsella allowed it once, trying to spare his wife's feelings, and now wants to try it another way.
Mm-hmm.
That's how I'm reading this, at least. Mm-hmm. And again, I think that that's one of the things that she kind of keeps secret from herself. She knows that they can't take the girl out in public wearing her dead son's clothes, but maybe they can. And that's a kind of self-deception that I think we can all sympathize with as we wrestle with grief. I think it's really powerfully done.
Oh yeah, and I think there's even another dimension. If you take Keegan's own sense that talking about her characters like they were real, Mrs. Kinsella does not want to get too close. In a sense, if this is kind of a fantasy reincarnation of the little boy, that's one thing. But if it's this girl, if it's her as her, then she has to acknowledge that it's the narrator that she's getting close to, you know, a different person, a person in her own right. I mean, she comes around, that's one of the lovely things, and says, yeah, and also there's the idea that she's a girl and should be dressed as a girl.
I love that way of reading it. It saves Mrs. Kinsella the trouble of loving someone new again.
Right.
Which leaves her open to the possibility that she can have someone she loves taken away from her again. If she can just pretend that this is still her son, then she's already suffered the loss and the love is the same, and she doesn't have to put as much at risk by admitting that this is not only not him, but this is a girl. This is someone else entirely.
Yeah. And we are up on another break.
Join me at Heartbeats and Echoes at 10 o'clock on Wednesday while we explore the world looking for the echoes of the heartbeat of Mother Earth.
Bookmarked is brought to you in part by the Whitliff Collections. Subscribe to our email list today and stay in the know about all the great events, exhibitions, and news happening at the finest collection of literary, photography, and music holdings in the Southwest. The Whitliff Collections is free and open to the public. We're located on the 7th floor of the Alkeck Library at Texas State University. For more information, please contact us at thewhitliffcollections.txstate.edu.
All right, welcome back to Bookmarked on KZSM.org and KZSM 104.1 FM, your true community radio station, where we are talking about the novella, I think that's the proper term, Foster, by the Irish writer Carol Keegan, with Chris Gardner, and we have reached the point where there is a, it is revealed in the novel that the young narrator who is staying with these distant relatives with whom she's having a, beginning to have a very satisfactory relationship and who are very good to her, has learned that that they had a child, and the child died in a horrible farm accident. I don't know. And she learns this from a gossipy neighbor. Mrs. Kinsella allows this woman to take her home when they're kind of stuck at a wake and she's bored. She strides on at a pace I can just about keep, and as soon as she rounds the bend, the questions start. She is eaten alive with curiosity. Hardly one question is answered before the next one is fired. What room did they put you in? Did Kinsella give you money? How much? Does she drink at night? Does he? Are they playing cards up there much? Who was there? What are the men selling the lines for? Did you say the rosary? Did she put butter or margarine in her pastry? Where does the old dog sleep? Is the freezer packed solid? Does she skimp on things, or is she allowed to spend? Are the child's clothes still hanging in the wardrobe? And that's what gets into. And I thought that was intended to be almost comic. You know?
I think it's the juxtaposition, right? It's the largest patch of dialogue I think we get in the story mm-hmm. up until that point. I haven't gone back to actually confirm that, but that just patter of questions, it's just a barrage. I think that's meant to be played for comic effect and then come to a screeching halt mm-hmm. when we get to the child's clothes and the narrator finally recognizes what she and I had both missed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, it's kind of, although she's surprised that she missed it too when she thinks about the wallpaper and the clothes and how they fit and all of that. The Kinsellas, as I mentioned earlier, she is confident enough because she's been told there are no secrets, and so she seems to believe it, that when she is asked, you know, what did they...
What did she tell you?
What did she tell you? She asked me if you use butter or margarine in your pastry. Did she ask you anything else? She asked me if the freezer was packed. Did she tell you something? I don't know what to say. What did she tell you? She told me you had a little boy who had followed the dog into the slurry tank and died, and I wore his clothes to mass last Sunday.
No secrets.
No secrets. But she's able. And the narrator is clearly upset. She says, after she's told this, she says, I keep on walking and try not to think about what she said, even though I can think of little else. The response is for Kinsella to take her for a walk on the beach. And they go out and they even wade a little bit in the
yeah.
water, and it's very beautiful but windy and almost a little scary out there. It's dark.
Can I take a passage here?
Yeah, take a passage.
There's a big moon shining on the yard, chalking our way onto the lane and along the road. Kinsella takes my hand in his. As soon as he takes it, I realize my father has never once held my hand, and some part of me wants Kinsella to let me go so I won't have to feel this. It's a hard feeling, but as we walk along, I begin to settle and let the difference between my life at home and the one I have here be. He takes shorter steps so we can walk in time. And that, every piece of that is lovely. The moon chalking the lane is lovely. But that last bit, he takes shorter steps so we can walk in time, is a nice contrast to fast walking, fast talking Mildred,
mm-hmm.
who all but drags her down the road.
Yeah.
And it's the kind of concession that never seems to happen in her own tone, where she is allowed to walk at her pace and the world bends itself to her will instead of her being pushed onto everyone else's pace and time. And it's just another of the million small kindnesses that he does for her. And this is the night that changes their relationship. She'll wake up the next morning and follow him around all day
mm-hmm.
instead of following Mrs. Kinsella around.
Oh, I had missed that one.
Yeah.
I had missed that one. But he doesn't, neither of them talks to her about the boy. What he says is, strange things happen. A strange thing happened to you tonight, but Edna meant no harm. It's too good she is. She wants to find the good in others, and sometimes her way of finding that is to trust them, hoping she'll not be disappointed, but she sometimes is. And it's like he's apologizing a little bit for her having been exposed to the gossipy neighbor, but not talking about, I don't know.
Yeah, it's the full dodge. Before that, he gives us the idea of the colt at sea. He says, you know, the fishermen sometimes find horses out at sea. A man I know towed a colt in one time, and the horse lay down for a long time before he got up. And he was perfect. Tiredness was all it was after being out so long. And I think there's something there again about kindness, about salvation, about people having the patience to wait for you. Mm-hmm. And also something about the horse being pulled out of the water in a way that the boy was not. Mm-hmm. So a great many things are intimated here, and none of them are said. Mm. And Kinsella trusts her to figure out what's going on. He trusts her again when he shows her the lights, mm-hmm. Which I think is likely where we're headed next.
I was looking at his response.
Ah.
When he says, you don't ever have to say
yeah.
anything, always remember that as a thing you need never do. Many's the man lost much just because he missed the perfect opportunity to say nothing.
It's exquisitely phrased. Yeah. It's just right. Mm-hmm. It's just right.
Go on then. They go out and look at the lights from the lighthouse.
Yeah, they go out and look at the lights. And he is, I think, trusting her here to see things unsaid.
Mm-hmm.
When they are walking back, they only see her footprints and not his. He says, you must have carried me there, he says. I laugh at the thought of me carrying him, at the impossibility, then realize it was a joke and that I got it.
Oh.
Yeah. They get back to the top of the hill, and he says they had seen two lights out across the water. And he says, see, there's three lights now where there was only two before. I look out across the sea. There, the two lights are blinking as before, but with another steady light shining in between. Can you see it? He says. I can, I say. It's there. And that is when he puts his arms around me and gathers me into them, as though I were his own. And there's that as though again.
Yeah.
And that's like a lot of things of this day, nothing that's likely ever happened to her before.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of kindness and love from a father figure who not only expects her to understand things, but trusts her to understand things.
Mm-hmm.
And then physically shows her that he cares.
Yeah.
And that's
thank you for reading that. One more incident there's an incident also toward the end that creates a really disturbing parallel to the loss of the boy, because she falls into the well a few days before, after she's already slated to leave but hasn't left yet. She takes it upon herself. He's busy with something, and so the wife takes up his job of milking, and so the narrator decides that I could go down to the well for water, so she would have well water for her tea when she gets back home. It could be the last thing I do, meaning the last thing before helping them out living. I put up on them, and she almost... She does fall in the well. Yeah,
she's not wrong. It could be the last thing she does.
Yeah. I bend down with the bucket, letting it float, then swallow and sink as the woman does. But when I reach out my other hand to lift it, another hand, just like mine, seems to come out of the water and pulls me in. What did you make of that?
Oof. First of all, that is We've been talking off camera about a film version of this.
Mm-hmm.
That's got to play like imagery out of a horror movie.
Mm-hmm.
It's also the end of the chapter.
Mm-hmm.
That hand reaches up and pulls her in, and everything that happens next it happens off screen like a Greek tragedy.
Mm-hmm.
And we see her the next morning, cold and shivering with a little bit of the sniffles, but she's been pulled out one way or another.
Yeah.
The image itself is really powerful. And she's kind of meeting herself here for the second time. The first time she goes to the well, she looks in at her own reflection. The sun at a slant now throws a rippled version of how we look back at us. For a moment, I am afraid. I wait until I see myself not as I was when I arrived, looking like a gypsy child, but as I am now, clean, in different clothes, with the woman behind me. So here is her reflection greeting her again, and this time it's pulling her in. The first time there's that image of Mrs. Kinsella behind her.
Mm-hmm.
The first time it happened, it felt threatening to me, like perhaps she would shove her in. And then the more we come to know of Miss Kinsella, the more supporting that seems. And now this last time, she's all alone. There's no one there to hold her belt as she leans into the well. There's no one there to hold her up. And the Kinsellas almost lose another child to water.
Yeah. And the mother is... Mrs. Kinsella keeps saying, oh, look what could have happened. Keegan herself suggests that perhaps at the end, although they are sorry to lose her, that Mrs. Kinsella is in a sense relieved because she's no longer their responsibility. And
You can see how she wouldn't trust herself again after.
But I why include that? I didn't.
I'm still wrestling with it.
Yeah,
it's obviously intentional. It's obviously important. It's a really powerful image and moment, but I don't entirely have it nailed down yet.
The ending is very powerful. She does. Mm. It's simply return to her family. There is no big dramatic thing. They don't have a car crash or anything. So it's not powerful for that reason. It's powerful the same way the whole book is powerful. We have 3 minutes. Any last thoughts?
I've got 6 million last thoughts. When she does finally get back, her father is upset that she has the sniffles. It's as though he's received damaged merchandise back, and it just makes me detest him all the more.
Yeah.
I think the last image is just wonderfully, wonderfully powerful. There's a lot of animals in this book, and a lot of kind of projection onto those animals. We didn't get a chance to get to that.
Yeah, but a lost heifer.
Certainly good. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, I keep turning away from the mic, don't I?
Yeah.
I just read some lines? If we just had 3 minutes.
You can read some lines. But I should mention that the film, which we decided we didn't want to talk about yet because we haven't seen it, is called The Quiet Girl. And it was actually made in the Irish language. It is the first Irish language film to be nominated for an Academy Award. I looked at the trailer. It looks like it's quite faithful to the story, except that of necessity, if you were filming this, you would have to show something of the girl's home life, you know, because it only comes through indirectly. So that was why I didn't want to watch it before having this conversation, and neither did you.
I will watch it tonight now that we've talked.
If I'm ever going to watch it. One or two more lines.
Oh, that's all right. I'm going to read one sentence then just because I love it. This is looking at her father talking to Kinsella early. It says, a type of silence climbs and grows tall between the men while she, Mrs. Kinsella, is out. And it's a tiny little line, but Keegan takes such great care with everything. This feels so whittled to me. Mm-hmm. Everything is just being cut away, and what remains is jewel-like and perfect, and I love it, I love it, I love it, and everybody should read Clay Keegan.
And the book was Foster, and I am looking at a copy from the library, and I think you had one too.
So yeah, they have at least two.
They have at least two. And there are other books by her that are also available, short story collections. Chris Gardner, thank you so much for coming and talking
to me.
And thank you for turning me on to Claire Keegan. I really appreciate that. You are listening to KZSM 104.1 and KZSM.org, True Community Radio. And thank you for listening.